Welcome to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. Much of the political focus this year will be on the US midterm elections, which could limit President Trump's room for manoeuvre if Republicans lose control of the House. But in Europe, a less expected election result has brought another important trend into focus. German state elections don't normally attract much international attention, but the alternative for Deutschland's victory in Saxony-Anhalt has been a notable exception, highlighting the growing electoral strengths of parties outside the traditional political mainstream, with France's presidential election next year providing another important test of Europe's changing political landscape. I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Ulander. This comes at a time when established parties across Europe are already facing difficult choices around reform, public spending and fiscal discipline. So what could this changing political landscape mean for Europe's economic outlook and for investors?
Joining us today is Paul Donovan, the chief economist for the CIO. So let's start off with the sort of the initial question. Normally, the international attention does not focus on German state elections, and this is quite a small German state, right? I think it's like two million people. But nonetheless, the result is quite arresting. Why are people focusing on this, and what can we tell about the potential policies of the Alternative for Deutschland and why this matters?
Thanks, Chris. Well, yes, as you say, Saxony-Anhalt is not a very large state or Lande within Germany. The issue, I think, though, that this is the first time since 1945 that the far right has come close to power in Germany. It's still not clear they will take power in Saxony-Anhalt, but this is a big deal. And people are asking, well, is this a trend? Is this something we'll be seeing more of? Now, we do need to be careful here, because one of the things that has emerged is that the sort of anti-immigration rhetoric, which is a very, very strong part of the far right around many economies, but in particular with Alternative for Deutschland, that anti-immigration rhetoric plays best in areas where there aren't many immigrants at all. So if you have a diverse cosmopolitan community, people aren't afraid of immigrants. It's only in those areas where there aren't any foreigners and everybody looks like you that you suddenly think this is some kind of weird threat. So Saxony-Anhalt doesn't have a large immigration population. It's an outlier as far as Germany is concerned. And so we just have to be a little bit careful that we're not taking this too far in the extrapolation. But nevertheless, you know, the far right gaining influence even in a small land in Germany is something which is inevitably going to attract a lot of attention, just given the lessons of history.
So while a state election may have more limited direct implications for national economic policy, do you think this could result in maybe creating greater uncertainty around the country's political direction?
I think that inevitably we are seeing a polarization of politics on a global level. And there's lots of reasons for this. The rise of prejudice politics in many societies creates more extreme views. The decline of party membership. Most countries have got falling party membership of political parties. Also means that only the most fanatical people join parties. It creates more extreme views. The interaction of social media and artificial intelligence can be quite toxic in pushing people into ever more polarized views. So the point here, I think, is that what is happening in Germany is part of a far bigger global trend, and that increases uncertainty because, to put it in rather simplistic terms, markets are no longer having to price in, you know, the probability that a government shifts from centre-left or to centre-right or vice versa. They're having to price in far bigger swings in the political pendulum, and that's A, something they're not very good at doing, and B, something that's really very, very dramatic in terms of the outcomes. So I think that what's happened in Germany is that there's been this reminder of the extreme polarization that potentially comes through, not just in Germany, but elsewhere. And that does inevitably add uncertainty to people who are used to sort of flickers of the needle. And now you've got these wild jumps taking place.
You mentioned the stance of the AfD on immigration, but I guess I was also thinking about their posture on the European Union, which I know has been somewhat hostile or to sort of international organisations. It also sort of occurred that is there a potential here for sort of fiscal backsliding in Europe in general, that as established parties are sort of under threat, that the impulse towards fiscal discipline is loosened still further, and it's not that disciplined at the moment anyway, right?
Well, Europe's not too bad on the fiscal side of things. The United States is a whole different ballgame, but the Europeans, for the most part, are more or less stable in their fiscal policies. But you're quite right, there is always this background idea that, well, maybe the established parties are going to try and buy their way out of trouble, or, you know, this rise of extremism and prejudice politics is something that can be countered with fiscal largesse. The problem with that is that although it's a very seductive idea, it tends not to actually work. And that is because when you get these sort of levels of extremism, a lot of this is in reaction to fear of the future, fear that, you know, AI is going to steal my job, the robots are going to take over, and so on and so forth. So people get very, very worried about the future. And you might say, well, okay, well, that's fine. We'll just guarantee an income, or we'll give you more money and everything will be great. But actually, a lot of the fear is not so much around direct economics, so much as social status. And taking cash handouts from the government doesn't enhance your social status, generally speaking. So the risk, particularly with extremism on the far right, is that it's more about social issues. Far left extremism is occasionally, well, quite often, more about economic issues. But the far right, it's social issues. And that then is a problem, because you might get governments thinking we can buy our way out of this and it won't actually achieve any change. And all you end up with is still political extremism and a bigger fiscal deficit at the end of the day.
I mean, just a quick follow up on that, though. I mean, there's also the question about Europe, because the AfD, I think, had its roots in sort of hostility to the European Union. I mean, we're going to move on to France perhaps in a few seconds, but that hostility remains. I mean, to what extent should investors be worried about the integrity of the European Union, or does this sort of maybe sort of push the European Union towards more progressive reforms or some kind of change or modernization?
So I think it's not something we should worry about in terms of integrity, that at least in the, you know, the core countries, if you are in the euro, you're stuck with the European Union, whether you like it or not, because the cost of breaking up a monetary union is absolutely horrific. The UK could leave the EU with quite a lot of damage and pain along the way because it wasn't part of the euro. If you leave the euro and the EU, well, the lesson of the 20th century is if you break up a monetary union, you end up with a dictatorship or civil war or both. And that is in every single monetary union breakup, bar that of the United States in 1932. So it's a very, very, very dramatic situation. Now, if you look at AfD and other far-right parties, they've tended to dilute their hostility to the EU. Now, the EU is still a very convenient scapegoat because it's an external entity, and why not blame them, etc., etc. Very easy to blame the EU, and the EU very often, you know, provides quite ludicrous stories that can be adapted in the tabloid media very readily. But you're not seeing the we must leave type mentality. That level has been dialed back, again, at least for members of the euro.
So as you mentioned before, it's not just a German story. Across Europe, parties outside the traditional political mainstream are gaining more electoral traction. And with France's presidential election next year, this is also likely to bring it a bit more in focus. So how significant do you think this could become for Europe's political and economic direction?
So French politics is is a whole different ballgame. There is layer upon layer of complexity. I sometimes do not find it that surprising that, you know, we've had two empires and three monarchies and five republics in the course of the last couple of hundred years. So where are we? The question is complex because it's not just who wins the presidency, and we're still some way off, and we've still yet to see whether the centrist parties can coalesce around a single candidate. The second question is who wins the National Assembly. And in the event that Le Pen, the far-right leader, were to win the presidency, would the Rassemblement National, which is the far-right party, also win a majority in the National Assembly? And the supposition is that they probably wouldn't be able to achieve that. So that would then lead to a more divided government, not entirely dissimilar to what it may be transpiring in the States before too long. And in that case, you know, the question of who leads on policy and so on becomes a lot more complex. I think it is fair to say that under a Le Pen presidency, you would see the momentum for European integration being weakened. Now, that doesn't mean that you're reversing the integration you've already had. It means that further initiatives for integration, further initiatives to create a more common policy rather than a nationalistic policy, that's less likely to be coming through. So I think you'd be stalling on some of the integration. And it matters with, you know, with France or indeed with Germany in a way that, frankly, it doesn't really matter so much with a country like Hungary, which has had a far-right leader for some time until recent elections. You know, it matters in Germany and France because these are now the de facto leaders of Europe. The UK has gone. Italy is still there, but it's always been sort of the junior part of the leadership in Europe. So you really do need that Franco-German momentum. And I don't think you'd have that under a Le Pen presidency.
Do you think I could maybe have a double-barreled question on the United States? I mean, first of all, obviously the midterms, as we said in the introduction, those are going to be the most closely watched election globally this year. I mean, let's start maybe with what that might involve for the US and public policy. And then perhaps we can sort of turn back to Europe and some of the global implications.
Well, so I think the assumption in financial markets is that the Republicans will lose control of the House of Representatives. In a midterm election, the incumbent party normally loses seats. The Republicans have barely got control of the House of Representatives as it is. The critical thing there, though, is that if they don't have control of the House of Representatives, they don't have control of the Speaker. The Speaker would become Democrat, and they don't have control of the committees. The committees and the very powerful committee chairs would be Democrat. What that would lead to, I think, is effective gridlock on fiscal policy. And in that sense, what we are talking about is possibly some fiscal stimulus, actually, because you may extend tax cuts and so on, but you're not going to really tackle the fiscal policy one way or another. You know, Trump is not going to sign off on dramatic tax increases, and the Democrats are not going to go along with dramatic spending cuts. So you just end up with a freezing, which actually markets, you know, at least find relatively predictable. But the second thing is that if the Democrats have got control of the committees of the House of Representatives, then you are likely to see a lot of congressional investigations into the administration, the actions of the administration. We saw this in the last 2 years of the Obama presidency. And what that then does, perhaps, is tie up the time of members of the US government, members of the administration, and it reduces the ability of the administration to actually implement executive orders and other policies outside of congressional oversight, because, you know, every member of the cabinet is spending a lot of time with their personal lawyers working out what they're liable for and what they should be answering before congressional inquiries. Now, if the Senate goes Democrat, that, you know, conventionally the market at the moment, I think, is saying, well, that doesn't really matter. I'm not quite so sure about that, because I would certainly question whether a Democrat Senate would confirm any nominee President Trump puts to them, because the polarization, the really quite toxic environment in Washington at the moment, you've got to at least question this. In the past, there was a certain amount of give and take. There is no give and take at the moment. In that situation, I mean, clearly in the major event that a Supreme Court justice vacancy emerges, that would be a big deal. But what happens if Fed governors start to quit? What happens if there's vacancies for the Fed and they're not being confirmed? What you're going to be doing is then tilting the balance of the Fed in favour of the regional Fed president, it's got policy implications. So we can't dismiss this entirely. There's also the question of how President Trump personally would react to a defeat, particularly a larger scale defeat in the House and possibly the Senate, and whether that would cause Trump to be more aggressive in the MAGA agenda in the areas that he has control over. And this is where it starts to have some more concerning global implications, because the two areas of presidential control without much congressional oversight are trade and wars. So what happens with threats to Greenland? What happens with trade disputes? Is Trump going to seek to say, well, look, it's not my fault we lost. It's because the Europeans aren't playing fair on trade, or we need to be more aggressive on China, or let's invade Cuba, Greenland, or whatever. That sort of rhetoric and that sort of action is significant. And from Europeans' perspective, I mean, yes, there's the issue of trade tariffs and reciprocal tariffs and the consequences of all of that. There's the issue of, are you moving towards a settlement in the Gulf, or is the situation a forever war? But there's also the longer term issue about levels of trust in the United States, confidence in US institutions, rule of law, which has already become an issue. I mean, hence, the Dutch, quietly moving out the back door of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York with as much gold as they can possibly carry and bringing it over to Europe. I mean, this sort of thing is very unusual. This is not normal behavior. And so I think the main international issue, it's not so much that you get a paralysis of US government in terms of fiscal policy, or even that the Fed's balance of power tilts one way or another. The question is going to be, does President Trump double down on some of the policies he's been pursuing?
Yes, so maybe just a follow-up from that. Do you think then Europe should be more concerned about renewed tensions with the U.S. or about becoming more closely drawn into a strategic competition between the U.S. and China?
I would argue that Europe is already slowly seeking to detach itself from at least the degree of dependence that it has historically had on the relationship with the United States. And if you'll forgive a British example, and I appreciate Britain is quasi-European rather than European, but over the summer, the UK government put out for tenders for a missile program, basically doing a cheaper, simpler version of Patriot missiles, which it intends to start producing by the end of the year and selling to or donating to Ukraine. So there's nothing particularly surprising about that. This is just the UK's defence industry shifting. What I think was a surprise was that the UK specified that an absolute requirement for manufacturing these missiles was that no component should come from the United States. And even 2 years ago, that would have been an inconceivable idea. But the British government is implicitly saying, you know what, we're not sure we can rely on this supply chain, so we're going to change. So we're already seeing this sort of thing. The Dutch central bank's gold movement, it's a gesture. It has no foreign exchange implication. It has no gold market implication. It's a gesture. But it's a gesture which is indicative, I think, of the general direction of travel. And I think over time, defence procurement in Europe, also for that matter, and quite relevant, I think, defence procurement in the Middle East, is going to pivot away from the United States, less dependency on the United States, a more diverse supply chain, and probably a more nationally based supply chain simultaneously. You want where you are buying from overseas, you want a wider range of suppliers, and domestically that becomes more important.
I think, it kind of comes to a point that we've spoken about a lot before, and I know you're not sort of keen on the sort of concept of deglobalization, but I've forgotten what your alternative framing of this is. We're moving, it seems, then as the fringes of the political establishment become more powerful and more important, towards a very different kind of economic system.
Well, I think certainly you're seeing a less collaborative system. And there are certain areas where this is a concern. But there are also areas where actually deglobalization is quite difficult. So, yes, you are seeing from the far right in particular quite a lot of hostility towards things like sustainability. But actually, sustainability policy isn't changing because global consumers are part of a global media network. I mean, social media has many faults, but it is a global connection. And consumers want sustainability. And they are, you know, using their economic power to force global companies to achieve sustainability, regardless of what politicians are saying in the background. So the trends there are continuing. On deglobalization, the point that I tend to make is that you are going to see some deglobalization. That is to say, politicians are going to interfere. They're going to mess up global trade. And we've seen a stagnation of global trade really now for 15 years or more. When you look at global trade as a share of GDP. But you will also see localization, which is where it's just more efficient to produce locally. It's economically beneficial to produce locally. And that's a consequence of technology and simplification, supply chains and so on. And there's an overlap between these two. But I think my concern is that in some of the regulatory environments, you are not going to get a global regulatory environment emerging. You know, the World Trade Organization, you know, is now in the background. I mean, nobody really is giving it a lot of credibility. You know, its primary use is to produce data and little more than that. If you look at new areas like AI, collaboration and cooperation there may be quite difficult to achieve. So I think the regulatory environment is probably going to be more chaotic. And the issue there is, this is what a very prominent economist in trade has called the spaghetti bowl of regulation. Rather than having a nice coordinated approach, you've got this complex mass where everything is intertwined and you're not really sure, you know, how to eat it. That's exactly the sort of problem you get. And for a company, that then becomes a disincentive, perhaps, to trade because, I can't be bothered to deal with the US regulation and the Canadian regulation and the European regulation. Why don't we just stick with the European and forget everyone else, and you then end up with a more parochial worldview over time.
So do you think forces, such as the reorganization of supply chains and the push for greater strategic autonomy could create new investment opportunities, maybe specifically in the European market?
So absolutely. I mean, I think there are going to be changes. So localization is about efficiency. It's an economic good. You're deciding to simplify your supply chain because automation and robotics can lower production costs, reduce the need to outsource to find cheap labor, and lower post-production costs, which is one of the key things with localization. And that creates some really interesting opportunities. The technology itself alongside this, so robotics, automation, AI, social media as a technology form as well, all of these things create opportunities. And they create different opportunities given the cultures and social structures and increasingly the demographics of different countries. Demographics is the issue which nobody talks about because it's dull and boring. But actually, we've got really big demographic changes taking place and it's very, very significant. All of this together is going to create opportunities. But of course, along with opportunities, it also creates risks. And that's the issue, that in a more nationalistic environment, in an environment where putting in place barriers becomes a lot more acceptable, we're not just talking here about trade barriers. We're talking here about capital flow barriers as well. Flows out and flows in could start to become more and more restricted. So there's a whole mess of things here which also create risks. So the question is, how are you going to invest as you go forwards when there are going to be opportunities out there, but there are also greater risks investing anywhere in the world? If you say, no, I'm just going to invest at home, okay, well, fine. But what if the government decides that it would rather like your wealth to be just invested in government bonds, and all of a sudden your pension fund is no longer invested in our diverse portfolio, it's entirely going into the 10-year treasury bond because Treasury Secretary Bessent wants a yield below 4%? I mean, it could happen. It's happened in the past. It could happen in the future. So you need to strive for the diversification, but be aware that the risks are also going up in this environment. It makes for more complexity, which is why we need more economists.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for more questions, but thanks, Paul, for joining us again, and thanks to our listeners as well. We can delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. But just to quickly sum up, while political change and a more fragmented global landscape may create greater uncertainty, investors should stay focused on the structural trends reshaping the economy. Areas such as AI, automation, and robotics could benefit as companies look to boost productivity and simplify supply chains, while increasing efforts to localize production and strengthen strategic autonomy may create opportunities in infrastructure, industrial technology, and defense. Against a more complex geopolitical backdrop, maintaining a diversified portfolio remains key. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond. In the meantime, have a great week.
This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/cio-disclaimer.